For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
We're very excited to present this year's course, Great Controversies in Jewish History. This is our first class in the series. This year's course, The Great Controversies in Jewish History, has been sponsored very generously by the Ovadia family in memory of Yossi's parents, Shimon, Shlomo, and Margalit Ovadia, and it should be a merit for them. We thank you very much to the entire Ovadia family for sponsoring this year's course. Tonight is also the yard site of the mother of Barbara Fisher, Eleanor Leiden, Oliachaya Vas Aharon. And thank you to the to Barbara Fisher for sponsoring and in memory of the yartzeit of her mother. Thank you very much, Barbara. And I would like to thank Sai and Marsha Landi for sponsoring this evening's program. So I'd like to give it a tremendous debt of gratitude to the Landi. In honor of their parents that we have tonight's special program with our guest of honor. So since none of you are here to hear me speak or give any more announcements, without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Berowine.
There are two different categories of controversies that exist in Jewish history. One category is between Jews and Jews, and one category is between Jews and the non-Jewish world. Sometimes they blend together, but most of the time they are distinct. But nevertheless, both categories do influence one another. So I want to give you an overview, if I may, of the controversies that I think are most essential for an understanding of Jewish history. And at the end of my brilliant remarks, there'll be time for questions, if you so desire. The great controversy that occurred in Jewish life in the time of the First Temple had to do with idolatry and paganism versus the Jewish ideas of monotheism. It was a strange time because there were prophets amongst the Jewish people, such as Elijah and Elisha, other great prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah. But the people, the vast majority of the people, were guilty of paganism. Now, for us, it's very difficult to understand paganism because, so to speak, it's not in vogue today. The Talmud itself records for us a story that one of the kings of Israel, of Judah rather, Manasseh, had a dream and appeared to one of the great rabbis rather in a dream. And the rabbi asked him a complicated halachic question. And Manasseh answered it, told him what the halachic answer would be. So the rabbi in the dream asked him, he said, if you're such a scholar and such a Talmudic expert, how did you worship idols? And he said to him, if you would have lived in our generation, in the milieu of our time, he said, you would have picked up the hem of your garment to run more quickly to worship the idol. By that, the rabbis meant to teach us that we are influenced by society. And no matter how wicked society is, it influences us. You know, I went to public school. When I went to public school in Chicago, there was a separate entrance for boys and for girls. in public school. And it was engraved in stone on the lintel of the school. And today, we've come a long way, baby. Society changes. So in the society of the first temple, paganism was the dominant society, with everything that paganism implied. Because paganism does not come without baggage. Nothing comes without baggage. So with it came sexual immorality, with it came violence, with it came murder, and with it came the destruction of the first temple. A small minority of Jews were not pagans. The prophet Elijah says, I only found 7,000 Jews in the land of Israel who had not bowed down to the Baal and had not kissed it. 7,000 out of a few million. But the destruction of the temple had a sobering effect on the Jewish people. So therefore the Talmud teaches us that in the second temple the rampant paganism that existed in the first temple did not exist. In the second temple, however, there were other challenges. So in the year 325 before the Common Era, Alexander the Great comes to the land of Israel. He's conquering the world. He's on the way to India. And he stops in Jerusalem. And there he meets the high priest of Israel, who was also the head of the Jewish community, Shimon HaTzadik, the righteous Shimon. And out of deference to him, he does not destroy the temple. He merely exacts from the Jews a monetary tribute. However, coming with Alexander comes Greek culture and comes the Greek language. The Jews, out of gratitude to Alexander, agreed that all the male children born that year would be called Alexander. And that's how Alexander became a Jewish name. Sender, Alexander. And once Alexander became a Jewish name, then all the Greek names became a Jewish name. And Greek language entered the Jewish world, so that the Bible was translated into Greek. The Septuagint, the 70 scholars who sat in one room and translated, agreed on a translation. Now, that was miraculous that 70 Jewish scholars would agree on anything. And this Greek translation became the basis for the translation of the Bible later in Christianity, like the Latin Bible, the Douay Bible of the Catholic Church is a translation from the Greek Bible. And the King James Version is an English translation from the Latin version, from the Greek version, from the Hebrew version. And we all know, it's like playing telephone, we all know that somehow something gets lost in the translation. So for instance, the famous idea of the virgin birth, which is, I don't mean the pun, which is a cardinal principle of Catholicism today, is based simply on a mistranslation. Because the Hebrew word in Isaiah is Alma. Alma in Hebrew means a young girl. The Greeks translated it as a young girl, but it also means a virgin in Greek. And the Latin took only the virgin and not the young girl, as did the King James and all the other ones. Hence, you have the Marian doctrine within the church today. But once it's established, you cannot disprove it no matter what. So now there became the great influence of Greek culture. So the rabbi announced that you're going to have a class on the Hellenists. So that's one of the first major controversies in Jewish life, is the Hellenists versus the rabbinic Jews. The Hellenists basically said, Greek culture is wonderful. It's art, it's music, it's architecture, it's theater, it's drama, it's literature, it's Homer. How can we not incorporate that within us? And the rabbi said, well, with it comes all the other baggage. And the Greek world was an immoral world, it was a violent world. And therefore, a great struggle ensued. Now, Alexander the Great conquered the world. The Greeks were dominant for almost 300 years. If you're living in the middle of that 300-year period, because we have, relatively speaking, short lifespans, well, you think that that's going to be forever. The Greeks have been there 150 years, and you know, and they're unchallenged, and they're the greatest empire in the world. And if somebody in 1950 would have told you that there would have been no Soviet Union within 40 years, you would have said, you know, take two aspirin and a shower and call me in the morning. So the Hellenists figured that the Greeks are there forever, and the Jews are never going to be strong enough to fight the Greeks. So we're going to adopt their culture with all of the baggage that that contained. Almost a third of the Jewish people became Hellenists. And the Greeks erected a statue of Zeus in the temple. And they enforced, you know, there's nothing new in the world. The Greeks are the first ones that said that circumcision should be banned. They said it's a mutilation of the human body. So today that idea has taken hold in a different form, but it's the same idea, that we're going to rid the Jews of their faith, of their covenant. And they said the dietary laws are silly. But the Jews were stubborn. You know, if you treat us nicely, we'll do anything. But if you're difficult with us, then Jews become stubborn. So the Jews were stubborn, and the Greeks attempt to enforce it. You have the great war of the Maccabees against the Syrian Greek government, and you have a period of 103 years where of Jewish independence under the reign of the Maccabees. So that's one great controversy. What to do with Greek culture? Now, that all the controversies in Jewish life don't go away. They are never settled. They sometimes abate. They sometimes become weaker because of new controversies. But they never go away. And therefore, we'll see great controversies regarding the study of Greek philosophy. Is Aristotle compatible with Judaism? Is there a good reason to study Aristotle? So in our world today, it really doesn't count for much because we're not really philosophically driven anymore. You know, the famous anecdote regarding the great philosopher who lay on his deathbed, and his disciples said to him, Master, before you depart the world, what are your last words to us? And he said to them, life is a river. And so it went all around the room. The master said, life is a river, life is a river. The little guy in the back says, what does he mean, life is a river? So now the question comes all the way back again. And now the great master is on the way out. And they say, before you depart, master, tell us, what do you mean, life is a river? So he says, so it's not a river. That's philosophy. And so to us, you know, so it's not a river. What's the difference? But in Jewish history, it was a bitter controversy, especially in the period of Maimonides, in the 12th and 13th centuries, throughout the Mediterranean countries, and certainly amongst the Sephardim, not so much amongst the Ashkenazic community, which didn't deal with Aristotle at all. But for instance, the Rambam Maimonides is an Aristotelian. He adopts Aristotle's physics and Aristotle's astronomy. He doesn't adopt his philosophy completely, but much of his philosophy is based on Aristotle. And so therefore there arose a controversy. Why should we allow Aristotle, so to speak, into the study hall? Why should we have anything to do with him? And to a certain extent, that controversy still remains today. You know, how much outside culture, how much secular knowledge, how much all of these things that apparently are not intrinsically Jewish, how much of that should be allowed or is necessary or really contributes to Jewish survival. So that's one controversy with the Greeks. Second controversy is with the Romans. Thank you. The controversy with the Romans is not one of culture or philosophy. It's one of nationalism. The Romans generally were tolerant of all religions, but they were not tolerant of people who wanted to have a national entity within their empire. And that was the rebellion against Rome, and the Second Temple is destroyed, and the Romans then, there's a second revolution by Bar Kokhba in 135, and then finally the Romans had their fill of us, and they attempted to exterminate all the Jewish leaders and study halls, etc. Reign of terror that lasted 60 years until finally there was a change in emperors and a change in viewpoint, and the Jews came to a modus vivendi with the Romans. Which brings us to probably the most significant controversy, is the rise of Christianity. How did that happen? So rebellion against Rome before the destruction of the temple encouraged a messianic belief amongst the Jews. Now, one of the principles of our faith is that there is a Messiah that will not only redeem us, but redeem all of mankind by different definitions of what redeem means. Maimonides, for instance, has a very bland messianic era. He says nothing's going to change. I mean, the Chicago Cubs are not going to win the World Series. Nothing's going to change. Except, he said, that It's interesting. He says there'll be great technology and there'll be easy to make a living, and that nations will be able to settle disputes, and that the strong will not automatically overwhelm the weak. But there is a grander vision of the Messianic era, that the Messiah will solve all problems. Later it merged even with the belief in the resurrection of the dead, that the Messianic era, even though Maimonides specifically says that that's not the case, but that somehow the two will blend together. So there was Messianic fervor amongst the Jewish people. And in that Messianic fervor arises a figure who has Messianic pretensions. Now, one of the disputes between Christianity and Judaism is regarding Jesus himself. When did he live? Who was he? The Jews date him much earlier than the Christians. So the Jews say we must be talking about somebody else. According to Jewish date, it's at least 165 years before the Common Era. And in any event, he is crucified by the Romans for being a troublemaker. And around him arises a sect of Jews who believe in him, and who believe in him in not only in Messianic terms, but eventually the Messianic terms grow into godly terms. So he's the Son of God, he's a piece of God, he is God. And these Jews were observant Jews in terms of observing the mitzvot. So Christianity was Judaism plus something. The rabbis naturally did not believe in him, and they felt that this was a distortion of the Messianic idea, etc., and certainly could not countenance the idea that God would appear in a human form, or that he would have a son, or that such a thing as the Immaculate Conception, it's, none of these things could happen. None of them are palatable to Jewish thought and Jewish tradition. So originally, the original Christians, led by Peter, saw Christianity as a Jewish religion. And that's how the Romans saw it originally as well. And the appeal was basically to Jews. But it was unsuccessful. It was not popular. It was unpopular because the masses of the Jewish people did not feel that you could say that a person is God. And it was not popular because the rabbis took great steps to exclude them from the Jewish congregation. So we have, for instance, we all know we have 18 benedictions in the main prayer service, but if you'll count, there's a 19th. The 19th was a benediction that the rabbis instituted that basically said, we don't believe in Christianity. And anyone who did not recite that 19th benediction publicly was excluded from the congregation. That became the litmus paper test of whether or not one could belong to the Jewish people or not. When that happened, so there arose in amongst the Christians a man by the name of Paul, who was originally a yeshiva student. And he revolutionized Christianity. He said, we're not going to appeal to the Christian world. We're going to appeal to the Jewish world. We're going to appeal to the pagan world. And in order to appeal to the pagan world, we have to do away with all the restrictions. So So Saturday became Sunday. You don't have to circumcise yourself. You don't have to eat kosher. You're not bound to any of it. You just have to believe. And that became the criteria for Christianity, which spread like wildfire because paganism had run its course. Even the Greeks, Aristotle himself writes that, you know, you cannot believe that this piece of wood or this statue or any of that has any value. So as paganism ran its course, the Christians took over. When they took over, they substituted for paganism and they incorporated much of paganism into Christianity. Statues, icons, altars, etc. They also incorporated much of Judaism into Christianity. The Pope wears the garments of the high priest. You know, when the Pope visited Israel, so they had his picture on the front page of the Israeli newspaper. So two little children from Mea Shorim saw the paper. So they said, "Who's that?" So one said, "Well, he has no beard or payas, must be a non-Jew." And the other one said, "But he's wearing a kippah, so he must be Mizrahi." So there's much of Judaism certently in Catholicism. And they took over the entire Bible, which they call the Old Testament. And Christianity was convinced that Jews would convert to Christianity. After a few centuries, when that did not happen, the church turned bitterly anti-Semitic. Because that was their only explanation as why the Jews didn't adopt it. And Christianity established something called the witness people. Because one of the questions that remains in the Christian world today, especially in the Catholic world, is how come the Jews are still around? If they rejected Christianity and they're supposed to be punished for it, how come they're still around? And the question is compounded today, how come they got a state? That can't be. Can't be that their national entity is restored. It can't be that they control Israel. It can't be that the churches in Israel are protected by Jews. Those are theological issues. And it explains much of what goes on in the world today. So, because of that, Jews were faced with Christian anti-Semitism beginning in the 4th century and continuing till our day. That's religious anti-Semitism. And that's a controversy that remains until today between Christianity and Judaism. And Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews, always lived in Christian countries. And then later in the 15th century, the Sephardim also did. And we have had very mixed results. As exists today, for instance, in Europe. Europe is terribly anti-Semitic today. The lessons of 70 years ago have been long since forgotten. And it's endemic almost. So that's a great controversy that, you know, that keeps on giving. That's here. Didn't go away. But now, let's talk about one more controversy with the non-Jewish world, and then we'll talk about controversies within the Jewish world. In the 7th century, there is 622, there's a man by the name of Muhammad. who is an Arab that lives in what is today Saudi Arabia. And he's the head of a militant tribe. And he has a vision. Now, many of the visions that are ascribed in the ancient world can be explained today. You know, if you smoke hashish, so you have visions. It's very interesting. Even in the Jewish world, there's a famous rabbinic response in which the rabbi says that before he prays, an hour before he prays, he smokes his narjila, his water pipe that has hashish in it, and he says, and then the vistas of heaven open up to him. He sees the angels, right? He's stoned. But in a world that had no scientific knowledge, so then that passes for spirituality. And he creates a new religion, Islam. It's a universal religion. Now, both Christianity and Islam have in common that they are exclusive religions. By exclusive, I mean the only way that you can get into heaven is to be a Christian or to be a Muslim. And no matter how good a person you are, no matter what, it's not going to help you. It's exclusive. In the Christianity, you cannot come to the Father except through the Son. And in Islam, there is no God but Allah, but Muhammad is his prophet. And without Muhammad, you can't get to Allah. And here are the Jews that have no intermediaries. And there used to be a sign in the New York subway that said you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread. Well, you don't have to be Jewish to get to the world to come either, to have an immortal soul. The Talmud says specifically, righteous and good people, no matter who. So that we are not exclusive. And that's why, for instance, both Islam and Christianity feel impelled to convert the whole world, because they're doing you a favor. Otherwise, you're not going to make it. And that's why we are very reticent about conversions, because why should you have to be Jewish? Well, if you're a good person, you don't need to be Jewish at all, right? Then why take on the extra burdens unless you are sincerely motivated? So this Islam, Muhammad is convinced. He said, I understand why the Jews are not Christians, because Christianity is close to idolatry and it's got the Trinity and it's got all of this baggage. Now, I'm not for it either. But he said, here is pure monotheism. And in a mosque, there are no images whatsoever. It's an empty room with carpets. But he said, but you have to believe that I'm his prophet. And so he felt convinced that the Jews would somehow adopt it, because he felt that he removed the negative part that Christianity had, and the Jews would willingly accommodate themselves to his religion. That's why if you read the Quran, there are marvelous complimentary statements in it about the Jews. But there are also terrible, terrible statements about the Jews. So that the truth of the matter is that the Islamists, if they wanted to, you can pick and choose what you want to do with the Jews. In our time, they have, because of nationalistic feelings and the seeping of anti-Semitism, of Christian anti-Semitism, into the Muslim world, so they've chosen only to read the negative portions of the Quran. But when Muhammad became aware that the Jews were not going to convert, so then he also became very anti-Jewish. Because again, the problem arose, and what are we going to do with the Jews? How are we going to, you know? And Jews became what were called dhimmis. D-H-I-M-M-I. which means a second-class citizen. You're allowed to live in the Muslim society, but you have no rights. You can't walk on the same sidewalk. Synagogue has to always be built lower than a mosque. You have to wear funny clothing. You have to know your place, so to speak. But unlike Christianity, Islam rarely, if ever, conducted pogroms. And this great controversy arose, and it lasts until today. I think people, at least in my opinion, the United States State Department and many of the other august wise people in the world don't realize that basically we're talking about a religious struggle. We're not talking about territory. We're not talking about the right of return. All of that is smokescreen. We're talking about a religious controversy because just as Christianity cannot deal with having a Jewish state because that's a direct affront to Christian doctrine, Islam also cannot deal with the fact that there's a Jewish state within, so to speak, Islamic territory. That can't be. And until, therefore, there's a change in mindset, everyone is just going to be spinning their wheels. This has been going on for over 100 years. It'll go on for another 100 years, easy. I know that that's not a very cheerful outlook, but in Hebrew we say Zeh Mashiyesh. This is what it is, and in my opinion, that's exactly what it is. So this great controversy is here today, except it takes on political, territorial, nationalistic use, but it is basically this same conflict. Now, aside from these outside conflicts, we have internal conflicts within the Jewish world, internal controversies. The Hellenists morphed into the Sadducees, the Tzedokim. Sadducee is the Greek word for Tzedok, the followers of Tzedok. Tzedok was a high priest in the time of the Second Temple, and he came to, and I use the word advisedly, he came to change Judaism. The part of the struggle will always be whether we're changing Judaism or we're trying to change Jews. The traditional Jewish world tries to change Jews. The other Jewish world tries to change Judaism, which is a different matter completely. So the Tzedokim said, we are not obligated by the oral law. We're not obligated by any rabbinic decrees. We're not obligated by the way the Mishnah or the Talmud interprets Jewish law. And none of that is valid. And for a period of time, especially during the Second Temple time, they were the wealthier Jews. They were the more influential Jews. Many of them were even high priests in the temple. And the Mishnah in Yoma teaches us that the rabbis would ask the high priest to take an oath on the day before Yom Kippur that he would perform the service according to Jewish tradition. The Tzedokim eventually fell apart. But they reemerged a few centuries later in a strange incident that happens. The Caliph of Baghdad had the right to appoint the head of the Jewish community. And the head of the Jewish community had power, he had wealth, and he had patronage. It was a very powerful position. It existed for almost 1,000 years. It was called the Reish Gelusa, the head of the exile. And He was called a Gaon, the head of the yeshiva. These were real positions. They were not honorary positions. Positions of power. So there were two brothers who, when their father died, vied for the position. And the caliph, for various reasons, chose the younger brother over the older brother. The older brother objected, and he had followers amongst the Jews. And the caliph was very disturbed, had him arrested, and said, "I'm going to kill you because you don't accept my decision as to who should head the Jews." So this man was named Anan. He said, "Well, that's not Judaism. The Jews don't have the real Judaism. I have the real Judaism. They're fooling you." And he said, "All these laws that they have, and all these restrictions, and their interpretation of the Bible, etc., that's all made up by the rabbis. That's not legitimate. That's not our tradition." And he created a new sect called the Karaites, based upon the word kara in the Hebrew, mikra, meaning the literal translation of the Bible. So he said, "We're not going to use any of the ideas that the rabbis and the Talmud have injected into interpreting the words of the Bible. For instance, an eye for an eye. So an eye for an eye in rabbinic literature is always money. And the rabbis showed us how they derived it, that is what the verse means. But Anan said an eye for an eye means an eye for an eye." And it says that on the Sabbath a person should not get up from his place. So the rabbi said what the Torah means is that there's a limit to how far outside of the city you can walk on the Sabbath. And the Karoyim said it means that you can't get up from your chair on the Sabbath. And in the Torah it says you start to count the Omer between Pesach and Shavuot, Mimochras HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos, which means that we would always start counting on Sunday, which means that Shavuos would always fall on Monday, always. The rabbi said Mimochras HaShabbos means from the day after Yom Tov, not Shabbos, and they have all sorts of proofs why the word Shabbos was used and why the word Shabbos also means Yom Tov. The Karoyim rejected it, so they always had Shavuos on Monday. And there are countless examples such as that. It says in the Torah that you shall not light fire on the Shabbos, so we light the fire before Shabbos, and we sit in warmth, and in we have a hot plate that we put food upon, etc., etc. That's all by rabbinic interpretation. The Karoyim ate cold and sat in the dark. So in many respects, they were more stringent, if we can use that word. In other respects, they were much more lenient because they did not accept any of the rabbinic decrees. And the and the Karaites gained popularity. We should note all dissident groups within the Jewish people initially are successful, without exception. There are various sociological reasons for this. One of the reasons is because all of these groups promised to end anti-Semitism. And anybody that can offer that panacea is going to have followers. That you'll get to discuss reform in the 18th century. Reform came to end anti-Semitism. He said, if we throw all of this away, and if the synagogue is open on Sunday and not on Saturday, just like our Lutheran neighbors, they're not going to hate us. that proves to be an incorrect assessment. But all dissident groups have initial popularity for a period of time. So there were very strong Karaite communities throughout the Mediterranean area in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, even the 12th century, for 500 years. Because history takes a long time to play itself out. Maimonides writes that when he came to Fostan, to old Cairo, most of the Jews in Cairo, he said, were Karaites. He changed that, but it shows what the influence was. And there were Karaite communities in Eastern Europe as well, and there's a small Karaite community today in the land of Israel, about 3,000 people. And it's, again, it's a controversy that has not gone away. But the Karaites morphed into other types and streams of Judaism that have adopted the same ideas of denying the validity of the oral law, the divinity of the oral law, and denying the interpretation of the rabbis over the centuries as to what the Bible says. So that's an internal Jewish dispute. Again, one that continues today, because there are streams of Judaism today that say the same thing. They're not bound by the oral law. They're not bound by any of the mitzvot, you know. The definition of being Jewish is they've changed Judaism to make it, you know, their definition of what they want. So that is a continuing controversy with different names and different agendas even, but that basically is a controversy that has survived time, and I don't think that it's going to go away easily, but all of these groups sooner or later disappear, and then they reappear as a different group at different times under different circumstances. In the 16th century, we have the champion false messiah of all time, a man by the name of Shabtai Tzvi. Now, what happened then was, in 1492, the Jews were expelled from Spain. There were about 500,000 Jews in Spain, 250,000 converted to Christianity. It's estimated that 80% of all Spaniards today have some Jewish blood, Jewish antecedents. I was in Brazil now, you know, that's Portuguese, but in Brazil it's well known that there are many families who are staunchly Catholic who every Friday night light candles in the basement. And they say that's their tradition. So half of them converted, the other half went into exile. Out of the 250,000 went to exile, 50,000 died on the road. It was the greatest disaster from the time of the temple till that time. So when a great disaster happens in the Jewish world, there is a revival of messianic fervor, because we say that all these troubles are preparatory to the coming of the Messiah. It's like giving birth, so to speak. So first comes the pain, and then comes the child. So I'm told. So after that disaster, the Jewish world is ripe for messianic fervor. And there arises a man from Turkey. Today we would diagnose him as a manic depressive. So when he's manic, he goes 3 days in a row without sleeping. And then he goes into periods of depression. Well, in the 16th century, nobody knew about manic depressive. So they said a man that can go 3 days without sleeping, he must be a great holy man. And when he's depressed, he's meditating. He's communicating with the Creator. And he had a great publicity agent. Every Messiah needs a publicity agent. You need public relations. And his publicity agent was a man by the name of Nathan of Gaza. And Nathan writes letters to the whole Jewish world, and he says, we got the Messiah here. Shabbat Tzvi, he's going to bring the Jewish people back to the land of Israel. You have to believe in him. And the letter ends as all letters end in the Jewish world, send money. Almost a third of the Jewish world believes in him. We have diplomatic messages of the time, diplomats, for instance, in Amsterdam, who said that the Dutch East India Company doesn't have any ships to bring its spices back to Europe because the Jews leased all the ships to go back to Israel. And there were roving Jewish gangs that attacked non-Jewish neighborhoods to exact revenge for the behavior that they were subjected to. And the Jews were convinced. Now, the problem with the Messiahs is that they have to produce. They have to prove it. And he could not do so. I'm sure that you'll cover it in the course with much more detail. But the end was that the Sultan of Turkey got tired of all of this nonsense. And he got tired of the fact that this guy says he's going to take away from the Sultan the land of Palestine, which then belonged to him. And he gave him the choice either to convert to Islam or to be killed. And the Jewish Messiah converted to Islam. And that was a mortal blow to much of the Jewish world, to those that believed in him. But it was a mortal blow even to those who didn't believe in him, because what that did is it weakened messianic belief and made Jews skeptical about people who claimed to be the Messiah. It's something which remains until today. And it also allowed for the idea of secular messiahs, which is what Herzl portrayed Zionism would be. And because of the fact that the human messiahs in Jewish history, so to speak, have proven false. And not only false, but detrimental to the Jewish people. So there's this great controversy, and after his death, you know, there are true believers. There's a wonderful little book, if you have a chance to read it, called The True Believer. It was written by an American philosopher who was a longshoreman in San Francisco. His name was Eric Hoffer. He was a lover of Jews and a lover of the land of Israel. A very insightful person. So he wrote a little pamphlet called The True Believer. If you read that pamphlet, you understand Al-Qaeda. You understand a lot that goes on in the world. Because the true believer is never dissuaded by facts. You're never dissuaded by, by Navy SEALs. And none of that's going to do it. And so after the Shabbat Tzvi converted, no one would have expected that the whole movement would have fallen apart. But it didn't. And for the next 100, 150 years, there is an internal controversy within the Jewish world between the Sabbateans and the non-Sabbateans. And the controversy turned bitter, as one can imagine, a religious controversy always turns bitter. And it had a profound effect on Jewish life. Two more things I want to discuss. The first has to do with the rise of the Hasidic movement, which is in the 18th century. The Hasidic movement is a departure, but within the confines of Jewish tradition and of Jewish observance. It put emphasis on less, for instance, on study and more on prayer. Less on philosophy and thought and more on human behavior, on joy, on community, etc. And it was a very controversial movement, but within 100 years it swept the Jewish world of Eastern Europe, so that 85% of Eastern European Jewry was Hasidic. And the Hasidic movement itself splintered into many, many different groupings with different ideas, but overall it was Kabbalistically based. It saw the world, our world, as not being the real world, but the real world is different than the world that we see. And it invested itself in being attached to a holy man who was the tzaddik, the Rebbe. And the idea was that the Rebbe, the tzaddik, was connected to heaven. So it's like a plug that we have in the wall that gives us electricity. That plug is connected to the generating station somewhere, which generates the electricity. But if I plug in my radio or telephone or whatever it is into the plug, I am also connected to the generating system, simply because of the fact that I'm connected to the connection to the connection. That, in very simplistic terms, is the connection to the Rebbe. I'm not the great scholar, I'm not the great holy man, but if I go to the Rebbe and I receive a blessing from him, or I'm affiliated with him, or I'm his loyal follower, so I'm plugged into the socket. And the socket is plugged into the generating station, etc. So that was the appeal of the Hasidic movement, which generated a great controversy. For 100 years it was fought, especially in Lithuania and White Russia, especially by the Gaon of Vilna and others. But eventually the Hasidic movement has prevailed, and that controversy is today sub rosa, right? It exists, for instance, in Israel in the religious parties. So there's a Lithuanian religious party which is non-Hasidic, and there is a Hasidic religious party which is Hasidic, and they have to run together as United Torah Judaism in order to gain the necessary votes to cross the threshold. But once that happens, they split back into two parties who are constantly warring with each other. So again, that's a controversy that has not departed from us. It's not gone away. But the fires have been banked. I mean, it's not what it was. But you should realize that it is still present. And then there was the question of secularism, Marxism, etc. in the Jewish world. Now, the Jewish world bought into Marxism more than any other group, because, again, Marxism is a panacea. It solves all problems. It promises utopia. Anybody that comes and promises utopia will always find Jews willing to support him, because we're a utopian people. We believe that somehow everything can be made right. And therefore, Marx, who was an apostate Jew and who was an anti-Semite, bitter anti-Semite, He wrote a little book called The World Without Jews that Julius Streicher copied verbatim. But that did not influence Jews. The Jews believed in Marx. They believed in the Soviet Union. They believed in all of these ideas. And it was very prevalent. It was the idea of labor Zionism, but it had a profound effect on the Jewish world. And it's really what made Jews in our current political stratum almost universally liberal. Because that's the residue of the ideas of the left after the left itself has collapsed. Stalin cured many Jews of their beliefs. But again, secularism also promised the Jews the elimination of anti-Semitism. Zionism promised it. Theodore Herzl said, his famous statement, he said, the world doesn't like us because we're not normal. We don't have a state. We don't have an anthem. We don't have an Olympic team. We don't have a flag. So we're not normal. The world doesn't like things that are not normal. But if we'll be normal, if we'll have a state, and we'll have an anthem, and we'll have a flag, and we'll have an Olympic team, in his immortal words, he said, we'll be like Guatemala. Nobody hates Guatemala, except for the Guatemalans, but otherwise, nobody can. So the world won't do. And that is the basis on which secular Zionism was sold to the Jewish people. It existed and was successful because it was a religious idea. Because deep in the Jewish heart was the idea that we're going to go back, the land of Israel is ours, and we're going to go back, and that we're entitled to it. But it was sold as an antidote to anti-Semitism, which it has not done. If anything, it's exacerbated anti-Semitism. Because today you don't have to be an anti-Semite, I'm only anti-Israel. Anti-Israel is legitimate. Not only legitimate, it's the cutting edge of progressive thought. So secularism promised the Jew everything. So the Holocaust had a sobering effect. And generally speaking, the situation of the Jewish people and our opportunities have weakened the idea of secularism as a definition of Judaism. But it inflicted 4 or 5 generations of completely ignorant Jews. You know, we're the people of the book, but most Jews don't know what books you're talking about. They haven't got a concept. They don't know anything. So then Judaism is what you define it to be. Well, no faith can exist if it has no basic core, if it has no basic goal or belief system. And therefore, one cannot be surprised at what is happening to much of American Jewry, because they're in a raging ocean in a ship that has no rudder. And they will find it hard somehow to escape. I mentioned before that my good friend Dr. Tversky and I were discussing our childhood. I grew up in Chicago, he grew up in Milwaukee. So we were like, there were 100 Jewish boys on my block that I used to play with. We all went to public school together. But I was the only one that went to the synagogue on Saturday. And I went because my father was the rabbi and he made me go. I wanted to go out and play, like all my friends. And the same thing was true with him. So he made a comment to me, which I have repeated, which I think is a great insight. He said that generation of Jews wanted to give to their children what they did not have, which was affluence, a university education, chance for advancement, professions, etc., that which they did not have. But he said they neglected to give them what they did have. And that really defines what has happened. So it's not even a controversy today, because there's nobody to argue with. There's no idea to argue with. And that is a very difficult thing. I was very good friends when I was a Rav in Miami Beach with a Reform rabbi. The Reform temple was kitty corner from my synagogue. And we helped each other out on a number of issues that we... I helped him when he needed certain things. And he helped me raise money for the local yeshiva and my... So we were good friends. Yeah, and he said to me very ruefully, he said, I regret, you know, he said, what's going to happen? He said, these are such fine people. And he said, and none of them are going to have Jewish grandchildren. And he was pretty much right in that. So that's not a matter of triumphalism for the non-Reform. I think it's a tragedy for American Jewry, the failure of the conservative and Reform movements. He was chairman of Israel Bonds in Miami Beach. He was a great fundraiser. So every year at the Fontainebleau Hotel in January was the kickoff for Israel Bonds. And, you know, and he would make the appeal. He was a very good speaker. And like he raised $15, $18 million, you know, in the banquet. And then when the appeal was over and everybody, he said, 1 minute. He said, do you see these cufflinks? He said, if somebody will buy another $25,000 in bonds, I'll give you my cufflinks. So a guy gets up, and, you know. And he gives him $25,000 and he gives him the cufflinks. So anyway, to make a long story short, he sold his shirt, his tie, his belt. He raised like another $150,000, $200,000. And he comes back to sit next to me in his undershirt. So he says to me, Beryl, what do you think of that? So I said, Leon, it's too bad you don't wear tzitzis. But that's a controversy that, you know, that is not really the controversy anymore in Jewish life. The controversy is to try and somehow save what we can, whoever we can, however we can, and to remain faithful to our core. So I'm sure in this course you will hear many interesting things. Jewish history is fascinating. Because it's a story of people, and people are very interesting. And we'll gain an overview that will enable you to look at the Jewish world today also in a more positive way, not to get so nervous by what you read in the newspaper. All of these things have happened before. Many of the things are not what they appear to be. The whole controversy in Israel is only a controversy over the budget. It has nothing to do with God. You shouldn't worry about it. And we are accustomed here in the United States to controversies over the budget, right? So, you know, okay. So we'll survive that too. Now, I want to thank you all for coming. If there, we have exactly, 10 minutes for questions, if there are any. If you're all sufficiently intimidated, I thank you anyway. Yes?
Do you see a controversy growing with the role of women in your service?
It's not a controversy, it's a social change which is happening and will continue to happen, and that's a product of the changing in society. And that's what I mentioned before. Judaism is not in a vacuum. The changing role of women in the general society brings about a changing role of women in the Jewish society. Now, there are halachic limitations, but most of the controversial items that are discussed today are not halachic, they're social. You know, so there are women in Hasidic communities that don't drive a car. That is not written in the Shulchan Aruch, right? And there are women that do drive a car in other circles, and we don't even think that that somehow is a problem. And there are other examples. So it's an evolving situation. And it will continue to evolve, but there's no question that the greatest revolution in Orthodoxy in the last century has been women's education. And most of our great-great-grandmothers were illiterate. You know, they used to read a Trina, they didn't even know how to pray. They didn't know Hebrew, they didn't know how to write. And today, the great challenge to the yeshiva boy is that his wife knows more than he does. Which can be very humbling. So it's going to evolve, and the change will continue to happen. And so naturally, whenever change happens, there's friction. It doesn't happen without different opinions and different discussions. But it's happening. It's happening in front of our eyes, and it will continue to happen. Yes.
I listened to you yesterday, and you were very positive and optimistic about the Jewish wall. And
I still am.
I went home and I thought about anything going on so wrong, even in all the communities, and intermarriage and stuff like this around the world. The point is, how do we correct it?
We try and correct it one by one. There is no magic bullet. It took us a few hundred years to get into this situation. There's no easy way out. And the only way to correct it is to try and make people feel Jewish. I'm not even talking observant. To feel Jewish. That's what I mentioned. I think that's the tragedy of Reform and conservatives, that they were unable to make their congregants feel Jewish. Therefore, the next generation intermarried, went away. There's no perfect solution to the problem. Everybody, to their own extent, and their own families, and to their own circle, we try and do the best that we can. But I think that the core of the Jewish people is present, and it's healthy, and it's growing, and we'll see what happens. I don't minimize any of the problems. I don't minimize the heartbreak of individuals, but in the overall scheme of things, somehow it's not as bleak as many people would like us to believe. Yes.
Is it as bad as some of the things we read about the Orthodox going into the army?
Yeah, but that's all. That's money. It has nothing to do with any. It is not a principle. It's a political issue. It's the Democrats versus the Republicans. It's Obamacare. So people feel about it, but that is not the issue. The proposal of the Israeli army is to draft 1,800 Haredim a year for the next 5 years. And there are 1,800 Haredim standing on the street corner every day in Jerusalem that you should pick up, because they're not in the yeshivas. And you'll do them a favor, and you'll do the army a favor, and you'll do the Haredim a favor. So then why do we say and the world is coming to an end? It's Humpty Dumpty, right? Why do we say that? Because we want to be in the government. We want a bigger share of the budget, because this is this is an issue. So I always say you can't confuse Jews with Judaism. You know, you can't, you know, the papers and everybody, that's not the issue, you know. And the same thing is true on an everyday basis living in Israel, the Haredim and the non-Haredim and the secular, everybody is live and let live and we all get along together and etc., right? But when it comes to politics, when it comes to money, when it comes to all of this, so then all of a sudden, all right? You got to vote for my guy, you know. Well, okay, so that's... It's a rough and tumble democracy, Israel. Much rougher than here. There's no gentility in it whatsoever. And therefore, that's why all of these things are raised as great religious and theological issues when they are not. Yes?
I have heard where certain people that were born Jewish and maybe their grandparents were Jewish and had Jewish customs, but they grew up in... not practicing Judaism, but yet in certain cases when they escape with their life, perhaps during Holocaust years or other cases where they're very sick, they thank God when they make it. Now what's the answer to that?
You know, people are complicated, you know. People are complicated. You can thank God and believe in God and behave differently. That's it's always like that. We're not a very consistent race in any respect. We all know that we're not supposed to steal, but you know, but the IRS form is different, and other things. It doesn't. I don't condone any of it, but I am not troubled by any of it. Yes.
I'm wondering, do you see any particular patterns in controversy?
I think there are two patterns. One pattern is that, as the Talmud says, people always have differing opinions. So there will always be differing opinions. The only question is it within the framework of Jewish life and Judaism, or is it outside the framework? Well, that's one pattern. If it's outside the framework, then... then there's no room, so to speak, for survival. If it's within the framework, so then there's different opinions. So there are different opinions. And the second pattern that I see is that all attempts to provide instant and universal solutions to problems usually... result in disaster, not just not solving the problem, but in disaster. So we have to take it easy and slowly and bit by bit and problem by problem, person by person. And my Rebbe used to say, you have to leave something for God to do also. Can't do everything yourself. So I think that that's also a pattern in Jewish history. Pleasure. Thank you all.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.